I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Today, let me speak to the governor. 1 hour answering your questions. Call 801-575-8255. Live from the studios of KSL News Radio in Salt Lake City, it's Let Me Speak to the Governor.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for Let Me Speak to the Governor. Obviously, Gary Herbert is not our governor anymore. We are joined today by Utah Governor Spencer Cox, and we are so excited to be joined by him today. You can call us with your questions today, 801-575-8255. I'm Maria Chalaios, your host for the program. Governor Cox, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for taking a part of your very busy day and sharing it with us.
Maria, it's great to be with you. And I thought I was off the hook for a minute. I was
no,
go
you're
call
not
Gary
off the hook.
And get him on the line.
Nope. My apologies for that. I'm not sure where the mix-up was. So, Governor Cox, today is such an exciting day because you have actually told people this morning that more people are eligible to receive a COVID vaccine. And that's exciting. Anyone now over 65 years old can get a vaccination.
Yeah, Maria, this is a really big deal for us. And the best part of this announcement is it comes a week and a half before we anticipated we would get there. And that's a result of two things. One, us getting more vaccines. And two, our team's being better at getting those vaccines into the arms of people that need them. And so, as you know, we've been focused on those 70 years of age and over. And as of this morning, 62% of our state population that age and older have already gotten their first vaccine. About 15% have gotten their second vaccine. And we're starting to see a little bit of a slowing on demand with mm-hmm. that age group, although certainly there are still those. If you're over the age of 70, you still get to get the vaccine, still get your appointment, go to your appointments. Many of them are scheduled out over the next week, but it was time to increase that, and we want demand to always outpace supply. So now we've gone to age 65, and there's going to be a lot of people wanting to get those vaccines, and we encourage you to be patient, and again, check with your local health department on their websites. You can go to coronavirus.utah.gov, and there's a list of links you can click on to schedule your appointments.
This is a sign of optimism. It makes people hopeful, but it also makes them ask questions like, well, when do I get the vaccine? When can I get it? Is there any way just to really target a timetable? When do you think the next group will be able to get a vaccine?
Well, we've already announced the next group, and that next group are people with significant underlying health conditions. And those health conditions are listed. They're very specific. Again, you can go to coronavirus.utah.gov and click on the links to those comorbidities or those underlying health conditions, and those will begin on March 1st. Now, for everyone else, as I've said a few times, it's really a math issue. How many are coming in? And we learn every week that we're getting more and more, and we kind of have some projections out there as to what those will be. But pay attention, because we will be backing those down basically based on age. So after that those comorbidities, those underlying health conditions come on, then we'll next go to age 60 to 64. And there are still some other underlying health conditions that increase your risk of COVID, but aren't quite as serious as the ones we've announced before. So at some point, and the health department will let us know, this is all risk-based, that we will include those other underlying health conditions, you know, somewhere 55 to 60, somewhere in there. And that's how we're going to do it. So we'll try to let people know at least a couple weeks ahead of time. And that's the good news. And I'm just excited because we were originally, you know, targeting March 1st to move to 65, but our teams have just been so good that they said, yep, we're ready to go. Let's move it up and let's get it done.
So what would be your best guess then on that next group, 60 to 64?
Yeah, so our best guess for 60 to 64 would be sometime probably mid-March. It would be my best guess, maybe third week in March. Again, depending, a lot of this will also depend on approval of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and how much production they have been able to do ramping up for that. So we're expecting to have approval for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine by the end of February, sometime in that time frame, and that will help us get a better feel for how quickly we can move up those other timelines. But what I will say is by moving 65 up to now, that just inherently moves up everybody else too.
The biggest question is, I'm sure for you, is when can we get back to normal, right?
Yeah. We hear that all the time. And what I will say is sooner rather than later. I know President Biden yesterday, I think, said something about by Christmas, and I had to laugh because that's not happening. It's going to happen much, much sooner than that. And I do suspect by late spring, early summer, we will be back to normal. And the truth is we're so much closer to being back to normal now. In fact, if you look at the transmission index, which is something that we've been using to guide us for many, many months, we haven't paid much attention to it because things have been so bad that we've just been in high transmission. But we have several counties now that are in moderate transmission as of today, and a couple counties that are in low transmission, which changes. We don't have many restrictions here in the state of Utah, but we do have a few, and this changes those restrictions in those counties. And at the direction we're headed with case counts coming down, with our percent positivity coming down, with so much more testing than we've ever had before, and with hospitalizations coming down, that we will see people be able to do a lot more than they could do, you know, a month ago. And that will be happening over the next few weeks.
Right. That one big group that has been wondering for over a year now when they can plan their weddings are the ones that are trying to plan. And planning is just excruciating. Just trying to decide how you could have a wedding reception and do so safely. So I know that group, my son included, is really frustrated at this moment.
Yeah, those big congregation settings are the most difficult, right? Those are the ones where we've had super spreader events, well-documented super spreader events. We've unfortunately had loss of lives for those mass congregation events, but we've gotten so much better at those too with masks and other things. And so that's it. I mean, I really anticipate that a lot of those spring weddings, people will be very happy with their ability. And if you look at that transmission index, now, again, all of this information is available at coronavirus.utah.gov. You can go on there and see how things are changing, and all of the projections are very, very positive.
We all have our fingers crossed. And, Governor, the callers are starting to call in now. We're going to take their calls. Take a quick break. The number for you to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. We'll be right back with your question.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
And thank you for joining us for Let Me Speak to the Governor this afternoon. I'm Maria Chaleos, along with Utah Governor Spencer Cox. And we are taking your calls, 801-575-8255. We have James on the line, and good afternoon. Good afternoon, James. How can we help you today?
Well, good afternoon, Maria, and good afternoon, Governor Cox. Anyhow, basically, I want to discuss something other than COVID vaccines. With all the coldness sweeping the middle of the nation, I heard on the news that various state governors, you know, they were all affected from where I grew up in Kansas, clear on down to other states. They were discussing energy policy, and I myself believe in all conventional forms, oil, natural gas, clean coal, et cetera, including green. I'm not ruling it out, but I just believe our nation needs a complete balanced portfolio on energy policy, and I just want to hear your views on energy policy.
Well, James, thank you for the question, and it's great to talk to you. I know in a lot of these shows we have longtime listeners and first-time callers, but you're a longtime caller, and I'm a first-time responder, so I'm excited to talk to you, James, down in Provo, and I appreciate the question. I have actually had several conversations over the past couple of days with Rocky Mountain Power and with UAMPS about what is happening, especially in Texas, where they've had some real significant problems. I'm sure you've seen the headlines and maybe some of the videos down there. It's just crazy. And talked about, you know, how are we preparing for that type of eventuality? The good news for us here in Utah is there's a couple things. The first is exactly what you said. We have a much more balanced portfolio, and that really is important. What you talked about, energy security, energy independence, and making sure we have multiple energy sources is so important in these things. As I've been able to dive into the details there were a couple things that failed. I mean, first and foremost, especially in Texas, right? They're not used to this type of cold weather, and their systems aren't designed for it. And so the failures that we've seen have actually been failures in just about every facet of energy, even with a balanced portfolio. So a lot of headlines around wind turbines that haven't been turning. That's a lot because the wind doesn't blow as much in the winter. So that type of power during the winter months in just about every state is always going to be a challenge. And so that's part of it. There are cold weather packages for those turbines that we have here in Utah and other places that they don't have there. So that was a problem. But natural gas also, the wellheads can freeze up. And that's one of the problems they had there that made it difficult for natural gas. Coal has performed better in most of those states, although some coal did, I believe, got wet in some of those areas, and they were unable to burn it in the ways that they normally would. But also having other sources and other places available. There were lots of states that had extremely cold weather that haven't had the problems that Texas had. And we are part of a consortium here in Utah with many states here in the West that allows us, if something were to happen like that, will allow us to get power from them as well. And so we're in a little better spot than they are, than Texas is right now. In fact, a much better spot because we are prepared for those cold. We have had days where we're 20, 30, 40 below zero and haven't had those same power issues. But you are right. Energy policy matters. We have to have a balanced energy portfolio. And the United States needs to be energy independent, and that's something we've been able to achieve over the past few years, and we really can't go back on that, and it would be a mistake for the new administration to take us back. So thank you for the question, and I just want to assure Utahns that we're having these conversations and that we're well prepared.
James, thank you so much for your call today. Let's go to David, who is in Orem, and David has a question about the COVID vaccines. David, go ahead.
Back in December, when they were setting up who was going to get what shots, when diabetics were listed to go with the age group 65, that's not been recreated. My wife is a type 1 diabetic. There's lots of type 2 diabetics, but the type 1 diabetic is the most severe. My wife's on an insulin pump, has bad lungs, and if she doesn't get the COVID shot, if she gets COVID, she'll die. Can we get type 1 diabetics added to the 65 age group?
Thank you, David, for the question and for the concern. So we do have some approvals, I believe, and I need to check with my team. Give me just a second. I'm looking on this one. We announced today, of course, 65 plus diabetic. Okay, sorry. Yes. Now let me get this straight. So those with uncontrolled diabetes, and it's not everyone with diabetes, but those with uncontrolled diabetes, which are those with an A1C of 9% or higher, those do qualify starting March 1st. Okay, so that didn't change. When we announced that back in January, we announced that those would begin on March 1st as well as 65 plus. Now, while we've been to move the 65 plus up till today, we're sticking with our promise that we would start those on March 1st. And so those with uncontrolled diabetes, again, with an A1C of 9% or higher, this is a very technical diagnosis, will qualify. Now, there are lots of other people with diabetes that don't qualify yet. And this is really tough. And this is what I was referring to earlier. Our medical experts are doing their very best in a risk assessment. And, you know, I'm the same way. I have lots of family members that have very serious health conditions that didn't qualify yet. What they're trying to do is figure out, okay, who is at most risk for dying? And age is by far the biggest indicator of those that are most at risk. So if you're 65 or over, that represents about 77% of the deaths in our state. I mean, that's a huge number. Three quarters of the deaths in our state have come from those ages 65 and over. And so that's where the focus has to be, because we just have a limited number. And now on March 1st, again, these other comorbidities that are so serious, like uncontrolled diabetes, that will raise the level so that in your risk profile, those people look a lot like a 75-year-old when it comes to the rate of hospitalizations or death. And so that's what we're trying to do. I wish it would be so much easier if we could just open it up to everyone. But the next move, as we move down to 60, we will be looking at all of the rest of those risk profiles, including people with additional people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and including them. So I hope that that's helpful. Again, you can go to coronavirus.utah.gov and look at that list and see if your spouse or other family members qualify.
David, thank you for your call today. Let's go to Alan, who is calling from Provo this morning, and Alan has a question on education funding. Good afternoon, Alan.
Hey, good afternoon, and good afternoon, Governor. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm curious to know what you're looking at from an education perspective, and I'm going to hit a couple things to kind of tie this in, because it kind of tells a story. Utah currently has ranked dead last in education funding per child for decades, and it's just a joke to me, because we say how big we are for families, and currently I believe I heard Provo and Salt Lake are in the top five for top cities in the country. Everybody's moving here, which is pushing housing prices up. In addition, we have with the Republican majority, we have an aspect where we give big breaks, tax breaks, incentives for businesses to come to Utah. And we also give anywhere from 80 to 150 million a year, depending on the year, away in sales tax exemptions for businesses. And yet we say how big we are on families and the environment and our people, but we don't fund education, and we certainly don't fund our infrastructure. When you look at the Highway Patrol, I believe they've been working with the same budget for the last 20 years, and yet the population has done, you know, at least doubled, if not increased further than that. And I'm just trying to figure out, when is Utah going to choose to use tax money and to use taxes to fund infrastructure to improve our way of life? Thank you
for thanks for the question, Alan. And you said a lot of things, and I'll try to respond to as many of them as I can. So education has been a really important part of it was a part of our campaign. It was a part of our budget proposal, and the legislature has responded in a big way. But I think you have to understand too the underlying conditions with which we're talking about. So we have more kids per capita than any state in the nation. That's going to be a challenge for any state. So you start there. But the second piece of this is also important, because the federal government owns almost 70% of the land in our state. So you're wondering, what does that have to do with education? Well, it has everything to do with education. In most states, and if you've lived other places, you know this, most of education is funded through property tax. But when 70% of the state is not taxable, does not pay any property tax, that's a huge challenge. When you combine that with having more kids per capita than anywhere else in the state, that is also a huge challenge. We are always, always going to be near the bottom when it comes to per capita spending because of those problems. I would encourage you to look at another metric, and that is effort. The effort metric is how much do we spend per person on the state on education. And Utah's always been in the top quarter of that. We do better when it comes to shows that we do care about our kids, that we do have an effort. And nowhere is that more true than this year. We have record increases in funding coming through the legislature. And by the way, the legislature put this funding in their base budget. Now, this is a little wonky, but that means they pass a base budget at the very beginning of the year. In case we can't agree upon a budget, at least we have something going forward so we're not left in the dark or government shutting down like happens with the federal government. We do stuff like that because we're very responsible here in Utah and we don't want to act like the problems we see in Washington, D.C. But this year, for the first time, they put that record increase in the base budget, which means we're not fighting over it at the end of the session. Over $400 million in the budget, increases in the budget, including an almost 6% increase in the WPU, which is the basic funding unit. 6% coming through a pandemic, we're increasing 6%. That's just huge. We've got a whole bunch of other things included in there, teacher bonuses, add-ons for rural students, teacher and student success programs. So many good things are happening there. The other thing, I don't know where you got your information about the Highway Patrol. They get budget increases every year. We've added troopers over the years, many troopers over the years, and we work really hard to take care of our law enforcement as well. And we invest in infrastructure, in roads and others per capita about as much as any other state. In fact, we're routinely recognized as one of the best states when it comes to infrastructure investment. So I think those are all very important, but you're right. Education spending is always going to be a challenge, but it's a challenge we can't back away from. We're losing too many of our teachers. I've proposed big increases in teacher pay, and some of those are coming through this year. And importantly, I've really focused right now on students, making sure that they're not getting left behind, those students who don't have the same opportunities as kids in more affluent areas. So focusing on kids in rural areas, kids in our multicultural communities, some of our less affluent neighborhoods, making sure that they have the same opportunities for success as every other kid, because our state constitution guarantees a high quality education for every child, and we're not willing to rest until we make that promise real. So thank you.
Alan, thanks for your call today. We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. The number for you to be involved in this conversation with Governor Spencer Cox, 801-575-8255. We'll be right back. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for Let Me Speak to the Governor. I'm Maria Chalaos, along with Utah Governor Spencer Cox. This is your opportunity each month to ask questions of the governor, and the number to call, 801-575-8255. Governor, we have Leon calling this afternoon from Ogden. And Leon, what is your question for the governor?
Yes, thank you for taking my phone call. My question concerns the election. It seems like every year they start earlier with their advertisements, their campaign promises, and the amount of money that is spent on advertising is a lot of times redundant and very annoying because you hear the same commercial twice in a row or something. So my question boils down to, why can't we set an amount of advertising money that the candidate can spend during his campaign?
Thank you, Leon. I think everyone agrees with with what you just said, especially coming out of a campaign season where my family, I mean, they would have to turn off the TV during commercials because it was just relentless, and we've all felt that. And I know it's crazy. It's even worse since in other states, especially in some of those swing states on the national level. And so I definitely feel your pain, and with would love to see some limitations like that. Unfortunately, there's a case, a Supreme Court case, I think it was back in the 70s, where the Supreme Court ruled that that there's a First Amendment right, so it's a freedom of speech issue that that allows for candidates to campaign as long as they want, and that prevents restrictions on the amount of money that can be spent on a campaign, and that's the real issue. There's been a lot of attempts at campaign finance reform, but they've always limited how much an individual can give to a person, and there have been, by the way, some constitutional issues there, some challenges around there, and another Supreme Court case just a couple years ago that allowed for these super PACs to happen, but in my mind, the fairness issue has always been one. If we had a limitation on how much could be spent, or how much time that people could use to run for office, and there are other countries that do that, by the way, and they seem to do okay, but that would take right now. It would really take a change to the Constitution to overcome that Supreme Court ruling. So for now, we're all stuck with those terrible campaign ads that run on a loop, and I apologize if mine were some of those.
And I think we've come off such a what do I want to say? We were bombarded this past election because of the outside money that came into our state due to the congressional race.
That's exactly right, Maria, and that's true. Especially again in these congressional races where even though they're local races, they have a national feel to them. As one side's trying to win back Congress, or there's a vulnerability, and people see an opportunity there, and that's where we see a tremendous amount of money. And not only that, but the candidates can't coordinate on those. And so oftentimes they tend to be a much more vitriolic, much more hateful, spiteful type ads, which are the kind that Utahns have said they really don't like. And we've seen far too many of those.
All right, let's go to our next caller. That would be Todd in Linden. Good afternoon, Todd. What is your question for the governor?
I appreciate you taking the call. I have a quick question about the vaccine. You read online, or you hear people talk, but even reading online, I've heard it said that it's not that safe to get that vaccine. One person, I don't remember who this was, on an online thing was talking about how it can be deadly to you, and we really strongly encourage you. She said, I beg you, meaning her audience, not to get this vaccine. Can you please comment on that, and how do we know that this is a safe vaccine?
Sure, Todd. Thank you for the question. And I'll tell you what's far more dangerous than the vaccine, and that's being online and listening to some of the so-called experts who maybe have a following, but don't, anything can happen again on Facebook and Twitter and some of these online platforms. It's very unfortunate that misinformation and bad information gets out there. What I can tell you is that the COVID-19 vaccines are safe. And these clinical trials, there were no steps skipped in developing these vaccines. We developed them faster than any time in history, yes, but we did it not by skipping these different stages but doing them concurrently. So doing them at the same time instead of sequentially, which allowed us to get the vaccines much more quicker, but also ensure that they were safe. And not only that, but by increasing the number of people who participated in the trials, these were the largest vaccine trials ever done in the world. I mean, we had tens of thousands, not just here in this country, but across the world, hundreds of thousands of people that participated in these trials, including some friends of mine who got the vaccine many, many months ago and are perfectly healthy, perfectly happy. They have immunity from the coronavirus, and it's made a huge impact. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some mild to moderate side effects that will happen from the vaccine. Those side effects happen with every vaccine, and it means that the vaccine is actually working. What the vaccine does, again, is it triggers an immune response from your body so that the next time something like that vaccine, which is the virus, next time it sees that virus, it remembers it and has the ability to attack that virus. And that's the beauty of our bodies. disease. That's the beauty of our immune system. That's how we were able to eradicate polio and measles and all of these terrible diseases that have been the scourge of humankind. And so the benefits of getting vaccinated just far outweigh the risks of getting the COVID-19 right now. And I would encourage people to please get it. Those side effects, now I have a couple people in my family who were finally able and eligible to get the vaccine. I have not yet. I know there were lots of governors and lots of political officials across the country who did get the vaccine, but I didn't feel like that was right. But my reason for not getting it wasn't that I have any worries about it. It's that I don't think it's right for politicians to jump ahead in line. And so when it's my turn, when people who are 45 years old are eligible and people with no underlying health conditions at that age are eligible, then you can bet I'm going to be standing in line just like everybody else to get that vaccine. And I certainly hope that more people will. We've lost far too many Utahns to this insidious virus. We've now delivered almost 500,000 vaccinations, and we haven't had one death. We've had some mild symptoms, a few with some moderate symptoms, but nothing serious. So please, please, please don't listen to those online voices that are telling you that this will kill you.
Right. Let's take our next caller now. This is Christian in Springville. Good afternoon, Christian.
Hi. So I'm actually high risk due to my congenital heart defect, and I'm wondering when those under age 30 could get the COVID vaccine if they have congenital heart defects.
Thank you. Great question. Again, I would encourage everyone to go and look at the list of those comorbidities, those underlying health conditions that qualify. But the congenital heart defect would qualify. And so, the vaccines are not approved for young people yet. So those under the age of 16 would not qualify for the vaccine. But starting on March 1st, and yours is one of those, you would be eligible to get the vaccine starting then.
All right. And thank you for your call, Christian. Let's go to Jose, who is in Murray. Good afternoon, Jose. How can we help you?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, Governor. I appreciate that you're going to be receiving the vaccine. I wanted to ask about home health care companions. We, like the workers in hospitals, nursing homes, routinely administer medication, do all kinds of healthcare work that other people do in hospitals in these settings. However, we are considered essential healthcare workers except by name. So I would like to be considered healthcare professional, essential worker to receive the vaccine with my mother, who is 70 years old. I'm not of that age yet. And I would like to receive it with her. I mean, I do everything with her. I'm always with her. We need to receive home health care from other people. We need to go to clinics and hospitals. There are other states that are allowing this, their seniors to receive it also with their home care companions. Can this be allowed, please, in the state of Utah? Thank you.
Thank you, Jose, and thank you for the question, and thank you for the incredible care that you give to your mom. I will say that we are so blessed here in Utah. We have many people that, and many more people every day who are in the same situation that you are, that are working diligently with a parent or a grandparent to help them and to deliver really life-saving health care, and we recognize that. And we appreciate it. Let me just say that there are certain decisions that I hope that people never have to make. And one of those decisions is how to distribute a limited amount of potentially life-saving care, which is what we're talking about with this vaccine. We have to make decisions with this vaccine. And they're very, very, very difficult decisions. While it is true that early in the virus, every state made that decision that frontline healthcare workers should receive this virus, receive this vaccine so that they could continue to care for the general population. We have made a change. When I became governor, I made a change and said we will no longer be basing these vaccines on where you work or what job you do, but we will only be basing it on a risk assessment because we have a limited number. And so it's a difficult decision. I fully admit that. And I know you're not happy with that decision, and there will certainly be others that criticize criticize it, but I have to tell you, I firmly believe that it's the right decision. By making that decision, that allows your mom to get that vaccine a lot earlier than she would have otherwise, because again, it's a limited amount. Once we have too much of this, that won't be a problem and anybody can get it. But your risk of dying is very, very, very low. Your mom's risk of dying is very, very, very high. And so I have to choose all of the moms in your mom's condition. And that means that people in your condition won't be able to get it yet. But if I gave it to you, then there's another 75-year-old mom out there who would not be getting it and who would be far more likely to die than you. And so while my heart breaks and I wish I could give it to you and everyone caring for anyone that is elderly, I just can't do that right now. I have to prioritize those. And by the way, again, those over the age of 65, 77% of our deaths right now. And that's where my focus has to be. Those age 30 and younger, it's a very, very low percentage. And so we'll get to you. We hope to get to you very quickly. We really believe that by May, everyone who wants the vaccine will be eligible to get the vaccine, again, adults. And so we can't wait for that day, but stay patient and please be careful. And thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, such difficult decisions. Thank you, Governor Cox. Let's take a break here. The number to call with your questions for our final segment of Let Me Speak to the Governor, 801-575-8255. We'll be right back. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for Let Me Speak to the Governor. I'm Maria Chalaos, along with Utah Governor Spencer Cox. This is your opportunity each month to ask your questions of the governor. And let's go directly to Marty, who's in South Jordan. And Marty, what is your question? Okay, let's skip down to John, who is in Orem. And John, what is your question for the governor this morning or this afternoon? Okay.
Well, I feel bad. John. I had a really great answer for Marty. I don't know what his question was. But
let's go back to John in North Ogden. John, what is your question this morning?
Yeah, hi, Governor. I'm just wondering if we're ever going to recognize construction workers in this pandemic. I mean, we've been essential from the beginning. We're keeping our state running. We go into people's houses every day, or are we just going to have to wait for our age group to come up? You know, I have kids that are compromised. My wife's been vaccinated already. I'm just kind of nervous about me with my son with lung disease and being in construction. Are we just going to have to wait like everybody else, or because we have been essential?
Yeah, John, let me just again thank you. You have been essential, and construction workers, if you look at the economy and really what carried us through those most difficult months when the whole world was shut down, construction was a huge piece of that, especially here in the state of Utah. As I look out the window right now and I can see just dozens of construction projects that are happening, and you've been huge. And this unfortunately just goes to my former answer. We've every industry has a really good reason for why they're essential, and you're right, construction is at the top. Grocery store workers have been just incredible through this pandemic and are really, really important. I will tell you, I do get a similar question like this almost every day from different industries, from lobbyists and people who work in those industries. We had the airline industry reach out to us and talk about how essential their workers are, and they're right. They're not wrong. It takes all of us to keep this economy moving, and you guys have done more than your share. Again, unfortunately, though, we have to focus on those risk-based assessments, and I know every family's different. I'm glad your wife has been able to get the vaccine. That's great news, and we'll certainly cut down on the potential transmission that could happen inside your home. But we will just... You know, if you're in construction and you're over the age of 65, you qualify. If you're in construction and you have an underlying one of these underlying health conditions, you'll qualify on March 1st. But we just really have to stick to that in order to reduce hospitalizations. And by the way, these are the things that are going to get us back to normal much more quickly as we reduce our hospitalizations have come down and as we prevent death. Then the virus really does start to look more like the flu, right? We heard that from the beginning. This is just like the flu. Well, it turns out it's not like the flu at all. It's 10 times times more dangerous, at least, than the flu. And we've had over 1,800 deaths in this state, and that's far more than we have in flu season. But once we get, again, the most vulnerable protected, then it really does, the numbers come down and it starts to look more like the flu, and we're able to get people back to the things that they want to do most. So I wish I had a better answer, but I hope you know how grateful we are for the work that you're providing, and I hope you and your kids are able to stay safe during the remainder of this pandemic.
Governor, let's take a call from Shauna in Pleasant Grove. Good afternoon, Shauna.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for keeping our city our state open and our schools as well. But my question is, what do the numbers need to be so that the kids are not mandated to wear a mask in schools? I think it's better for their socialization. And a lot of people don't know how effective the masks are anyway, but I think it would be good for our kids to not have to wear the masks in school.
Thank you, Shauna, and I appreciate that. And thank you for recognizing what we've done to keep the state open and to keep schools going. I mean, it's amazing. This is a national debate that's raging right now about kids being in schools, and Utah's looking around going, you know, we've been doing this. We've been doing this since the school year began, and we've been able to keep our kids in school. I would like nothing more than to be done with masks. I'm wearing a mask right now, and you can probably tell as I'm trying to catch my breath as I answer these questions. But we do have very good evidence about the effectiveness of masks. That evidence comes in many different forms, but BYU did one of the most robust studies and bringing all of the studies nationwide together that have proven that masks really, really do help cut down on the transmission of this. Also, interesting to note, if you look at the flu over the past 5 years, the average rate of flu in our state, and compare it to this year, it's almost non-existent. Which shows how effective our measures have been, and conversely shows how much more dangerous this virus is, because we've been able to almost eliminate the flu from the state. But this virus is so transmissible that even with everything we've done, it still makes it difficult. And so we're very hopeful. We do have the transmission index that you can find at coronavirus.utah.gov that talks about everything that changes as our rate of transmission comes down in the state. But the mask mandate is the last thing that we'll look at, because it is the easiest and the least obtrusive metric. So it's masks that are going to allow us to do a lot of the other things much more quickly. And then once people have the opportunity to receive the vaccine. And I think that's really important. And we're hoping by the beginning of May or middle May, sometime in there, depending on how much vaccine comes, that we will be able to open it up to anyone that wants one. And at that point, once everyone has a chance to get the vaccine, then it's on you, right? It's not upon everyone to protect everyone else. It's now your decision and your choice, and that's at the latest when we would be able to get rid of those mask mandates. So we're hoping they come sooner than that as the virus continues to dissipate. But we're working very closely with our health professionals and school professionals to get that right.
Governor, we just have a couple of minutes left in the program, so let's wrap up with, how difficult has it been for you with so much conflicting information going out from so many different people about COVID?
Well, Maria, this has been a challenge before COVID. We used to live in a nation where shared facts were a thing. It was just kind of assumed, you know. And I, of course, we had our problems. I'm not just lamenting for the good old days, but we had certain news sources that everyone trusted. And even if you disagreed, at least we were starting with the same set of facts. And I think that's been really one of the most difficult things. Well, I would say two. One is, now we don't have shared facts, that people are getting their facts facts from different places, and they're not even facts, unfortunately, but they're taken as such. And then the second is the politicization of those facts. So now it's we only believe the science that argues for our own belief system, but we don't believe the science for other things. So you can see it on masks, and conversely, you can see it on schools reopening, where it almost flips, right? And so that's really where we're struggling, but we appreciate partners like you guys who help us to get out the best information and to keep people safe.
But even with talking about just when do you think things will get back to normal, it depends on who you ask.
Well, that's exactly right. It does depend on who you ask. And so there's a difference, right? There's kind of this tug and pull between best case scenario on paper by someone with a PhD versus kind of the practical aspects of how people live their individual lives and the choices they make, right? So it's not just about the facts of the virus. There's also kind of a social science piece to this too, where people aren't going to stay locked up forever and people aren't going to stay. We're a social people and we need to be together. And so trying to balance those things to allow people the opportunity to lower the risk level, but still do the things that they need to do to be human, quite frankly. And that's what we're trying to do.
Governor, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to having the same conversation next month.
And thanks,
Maria. Thank you. And you've been listening to Let Me Speak to the Governor on KSL News Radio.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.